Welcome, listeners, to Bruin Radio Interviews, an hour-long interview show brought to you by the students and staff of the Brookings Harbor High School in partnership with Curry Coast Community Radio, KCIW. Content for this program is provided by the Brookings Harbor High School.
Hello, listeners. This is Bridget Mitchell, and our guest in the studio today is Brookings local Ray Gary. Hello, Ray Gary.
Hello. How are you?
Doing good. How are you?
Good.
Ray, we've read in the Curry Coastal Pilot that a certain Ray Gary has won several photography awards. Are you that Ray Gary?
Yes. I won ribbons in the Alaska State Fair in Fairbanks, and more recently I got a second place ribbon for a show here in Brookings, which is the only one I've really participated here in Brookings.
Tell us more about your photography.
Primarily, I'm interested in wildlife. I've always been interested in herpetology since I was a little kid. And a few years ago, I learned about digital photography and how much fun that was. So my main interest is photographing lizards and snakes and things like that. And I used to spend a lot of time in the Everglades and in the desert in Arizona. And unfortunately, there's not as much of that type of thing here. But so I'm gone a little bit more towards seascapes with a little bit of wildlife photography involved.
Well, I happen to know what herpetology is, but for people on the air, could you explain it to them?
Yeah, herpetology is the study of reptiles and amphibians. Reptiles and amphibians are not related at all in any way. In fact, reptiles are more closely related to birds than they are to frogs, but they live in the same environment, so they're studied together. Typically live in the same environment, yeah. I haven't found anybody here in Brookings that really knows anything about the local wildlife.
That's awesome. So back to the pictures.
Okay.
What kind of camera do you use?
My current camera is Canon with a 100 to 400 millimeter lens, which is pretty good for wildlife. 400 millimeters is probably about the minimum you want to use to try to get close to animals that don't want you to get close to them, or you don't want to get close to them sometimes. I went to Africa a few years ago and took pictures of elephants, and you want to keep your distance from animals like that.
How did you get the chance to go to Africa?
Somehow or other, we accumulated a whole lot of frequent flyer miles, so we had enough to actually go first class to South Africa and went to South Africa and Namibia, went to national parks there. It was a great adventure. We spent about a month there.
Who is we?
My wife, Gina Soltis, and I went.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Tell us about your wife.
I'm sorry?
Tell us about your wife.
Oh, well, I met her in Alaska where she worked for Denali National Park. She didn't actually work for the park. She worked for an associated agency that ran the bookstores, and that was her job, so she loved wildlife, loved Alaska, and loved books, so it was a perfect job for her.
Sounds like the perfect girl for you, too.
Yes. Yeah, in fact, she was perfect in that I would go out in the Everglades or in different places looking for wildlife, and we'd come across a pile of feces, and we would be examining it to find out what kind of a animal may have done that, what it was eating, and things like that, which I guess not many people are interested in.
My biology teacher, Mr. Bueller, who was just in the office a couple minutes ago, he loves doing that.
I'm sure a biology teacher would like that, yes.
He talks about this one time when he got to examine elephant poop, I think.
Yeah, we did that too in Africa. We my wife also has a degree in biology, and there was a bird, a hornbill bird. I think it was hornbill, I don't remember exactly what it was called, but digging around in the poop, taking the food out, and then while other people were looking for large animals, we were very interested in watching the dung beetles rolling their little balls across the road. We stopped at a rest area one time where everybody who was traveling through the park was looking for elephants that day, and we stopped and asked where the elephants were, and nobody had seen any, and we told the people that we had seen a snake eating a frog, and we'd stopped to watch that, and they all looked at us like we were a little crazy. Didn't think that was something worth looking at, but we did.
That's nice. During freshman year, every freshman gets to go through owl poop. They get to pick out bones out of it. Yeah. That's always fun. Mm-hmm. I got to do that last year. For all of you freshmen out there. Spoiler alert. If you were asked to give advice to a young photographer still in school, what advice would you give?
Boy, I don't know. It would depend on what they wanted to photograph. Learn as much as you can about the computer is an important part of photography today. Knowing how to work in Photoshop or another program that you can use to edit and improve your photographs. And then just my particular interest is in wildlife, learn how to approach wildlife and take interesting pictures other than just a standard picture of a deer standing in the road or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, find a deer that's doing something interesting or a bird that's in a tree, and then you have to learn about how the branches should be in such and such a way, and getting a bird that doesn't have a branch in front of his face. What you'll find is that the interesting birds all know how to land in a tree that's not only just too far away for your lens, but they also learn how to face the other way, land with a branch in front of their face, or do something just that you don't want to take a picture of.
So, Ray, are you a member of the CHETCO Photographer Association?
I am, and that's a group that meets twice a month. We were meeting more than that, but they've reduced it to twice a month. And we get together and share our photographs with the other members of the club, and occasionally there's outings where might go out and photograph a particular beach or something like that. And
why did they reduce the number of meetings?
Well, one of them was on Wednesday nights, and for some reason or other, Wednesday nights weren't particularly popular. The Friday morning ones are more popular, which seems odd to me because you would think that people who were working would be more interested in going on Wednesday, but they weren't.
And Wednesdays are pretty busy.
Really?
Yeah, I've always had busy Wednesdays. What about you?
Yeah. Anyway, it's just it's a group of people that get together and talk about their photography and maybe compare gear or something like that. And then different meetings, they might have one of the members give a little talk about a specialty they may have or something they've done some research on and talk about lighting or things of that nature.
Sounds like fun. What is your position in the group?
I was just a member.
I was just a member?
Mm-hmm. It's a very loose-knit group. There really weren't any positions. There wasn't like a president or a treasurer, and there wasn't no money involved. Each week they'd have somebody kind of MC it, and that was kind of by there was a few people that seemed to like to do it, but nobody really ran the club.
So it's like a loose group, just mm-hmm. floating through.
Yeah, friends getting together and looking at pictures.
How did you join?
Oh, I saw it listed in the newspaper, and I just went to the first meeting. Oh, is this something you plan on continuing with when you get out of school?
Well, I plan on going on and getting a degree in women/gender studies because it's just something that I'm really passionate about, and I'm pretty sure that's the only thing I can get a degree with.
So what would a degree in women's studies, would you be a social worker then or a teacher?
I could be either one of those.
Turn this around.
Oh, yeah. We always like it when our guests do that. It's fun. I could do that, but what I mostly want to do is become a counselor-type person for people who are struggling with their identity and sexuality and stuff like that.
Oh. Sounds sort of like something that's needed today.
Yeah, definitely. No more follow-up questions.
Yeah, when I was a kid, you would have been considered a crazy person, but that's different.
I'm already considered that anyways.
Okay. Do you want to ask a question?
Yeah. Now that we're done turning this around on me. We understand that you once lived in Alaska, is that correct?
Yes, I spent my last year in Alaska. I grew up on Long Island, little plots of land, 60 by 100, with little houses on them, and that was my life. Other than as a kid, I could find a field or a pond someplace and go off and play. But I spent my last year in the Army in Alaska and could never get used to Long Island again when I moved back there. So I moved back first chance I could and got a job with the Alaska State Troopers and spent 20 years doing that, and then spent another 20 years retired there. And 2 years ago, well, during the retired period, we'd snowbird. My wife and I would travel in our motorhome, and 2 years ago, we decided to stop doing that, and we moved to Brookings.
Sounds like fun. Tell us about the gun laws in Alaska.
That's kind of an oxymoron. There are no gun laws. Alaska was one of the first states to allow concealed carry without any permit or any background check or anything. If you can legally own a gun, you can carry a concealed gun in Alaska. Guns are kind of a way of life there, especially in the rural areas where I lived. When I stepped off my front porch, I was no longer the top of the food chain. So there are just a lot of guns. A lot of people hunt. There's a lot of subsistence type hunting. And there's a lot of outdoors people there, so guns are very, very common. Everybody has probably several guns.
What was on top of the food chain if you weren't?
Well, there's grizzly bears and black bears, primarily. Wolves we'd have wolves, but they're not really very dangerous to people at all. The most common thing you would get injured by would be a moose, actually, even though the moose wouldn't eat you, so it's not technically a food chain thing, but... cow moose protecting his baby is probably one of the most dangerous animals in the world. A bull moose in rut can be very, very dangerous. If you kind of walk up on one and surprise it, you could be in trouble. So, and moose there are just about like deer here. They're seen about as frequently or even more frequently. We had them. I lived on a homestead. We had them on the property all the time.
What was it like living on a homestead?
Well, it was interesting. We decided that we wanted to homestead, and for the life of me, I cannot remember why we decided that, but there was land available close to where I lived and worked, so my wife and I, along with a homestead partner who did the next property over, what you had to do is stake out the land you wanted. You were allowed 20 acres each, so my wife staked 20 and I staked 20, and our friend did another 20, and then you have to prove it up by building a habitable structure on it and live on that habitable structure for, I think it was 22 months out of 60. We lived there full time immediately. So we lived without electricity, running water, telephone. We made our own electricity with solar panels and a generator and a windmill, charged batteries, and lived the AC. Converted it to AC and lived like that, and we're actually very comfortable. About the only thing you'd notice difference in our house than anybody else's house would be we had a propane refrigerator. His refrigerator is a very large drain, had a tiny little microwave and things like that. But my wife was able to fill up 5-gallon cans in her job and bring them home at night, and that's how we add water. We had a little self-contained plumbing system, so that everything worked like that. It worked very well. It was very strange. And then eventually we got electricity, and then we got a telephone and a well, and before you know it, we had a suburban little house. We'd have 50 below at least once or twice through the winter. It would last a few days. The longest cold spell I can remember is it never got above 50 below for just over 3 weeks. My wife had relatives in Hungary that were writing letters asking if we were okay. It made international news, this cold spell. And the cold just seeps in and it comes through the walls and everything just gets cold. It was pretty brutal. Fortunately, we weren't on the homestead then. We were in a house that had real electricity and heat.
That's good.
Of that nature.
How did you choose Oregon?
The reason we chose Oregon is because of the weather here on the coast mostly. I didn't want to be any place that got very cold. My wife didn't want to be any place that got very hot. So this worked out pretty well.
What do people in Alaska think about Oregon?
I think there's a lot of people from Alaska that move here. And I don't think they necessarily have any particular thoughts about Oregon in general. People that are retired and leaving Alaska leave for the same reason. When they're looking for a place to live, they look at the same things, you know, what the taxes are like, cost of living, things of that nature, and whether or not the place they're going to still fits their lifestyle. I could not live in a big city when we came here to look at houses, I told the realtor that I lived on a 80-acre homestead with literally hundreds of thousands of wild acres around me, and don't bring me to any subdivision. So we now live in a house that isn't nearly like that, but we have 5 acres and we can't see our neighbors, and our property backs up to the Siskiyou National Forest, so that's perfect for us. But there are people in Alaska that live in cities like Anchorage and whatever, so they'll move to Seattle or Tucson or whatever.
Nice. You mentioned that you wouldn't live in a big city. Why?
I'm just not fond of traffic and lots of people. And my sister-in-law lives in Fort Lauderdale, and we used to spend time with her in the wintertime. And when we would go there, if we went to the store, we would get in the car, drive out to the main road, and then go 100 yards, it seemed like, and hit a stoplight, and then go another 200 yards and hit another stoplight. And before you got to the third stoplight, somebody had cut you off and given you the finger. I didn't find it to be a pleasant place to live. Brookings is exactly the opposite. Everybody here is very friendly, and it has all the conveniences we need. It has a movie theater and stores that we need, and there's a hospital just up the road. There's enough doctors here to keep us alive so far. Yeah, this is about as big a city as I would like to live in.
So, Ray, what is your relationship with KCIW?
I started with KCIW, I guess, about a year or so ago, and I first approached the people saying, I don't know anything about the radio, and do you need somebody to sweep up or move furniture around or something? And Tom Bozak, who's the president of the corporation, kind of gave me a job to set up a booth at a couple of the festivals, and then I got involved at the Brookings Cafe, or discussions at the Brookings Cafe, and from that I've gotten into my own music show now called What's Going On. I play what I call socially significant music. I play music that's saying something about society for the most part. And some people would call it protest music, but it's not all protest music. For instance, on the show I just finished recording, I played a song about Ira Hayes, which isn't a protest song. It's just a song stating his story. If everybody knows who Ira Hayes is, he was one of the people that put up the flag on Iwo Jima on Mount Suribachi. And he was a Puma Indian. Only 3 of the 6 people that put the flag up survived, and Ira Hayes being one of them. They brought the 3 back to the States to do promotions for war bonds. But that wasn't what he wanted to do. He felt a lot of guilt about leaving his buddies back on Iwo Jima, and never really got used to the idea of being a hero, and eventually fell into alcoholism and died of hypothermia in the streets. So there's a kind of a poignant song that Johnny Cash does about him. So
what other songs do you usually play on your show?
Well, I try to keep it listenable. You know, there's a lot of protest songs or songs that have a lot of significance, but if you have to sit and listen to every word of it, it can be difficult. So I try to keep it kind of light and interesting. Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant, which is a song you won't hear on the radio because it's 18 minutes long, and it's about the draft, and people enjoy listening to that. And that's a very listenable, fun song. I try to feature some songs by Arlo Guthrie. Well, there's a song called Masters of War that was written by Bob Dylan. I play a lot of Bob Dylan's music, but not necessarily by him, because I kind of think everybody else does his music better than he does.
So would you say that you protest against war?
Wars and injustice of any kind. I play some Dust Bowl music. Bruce Springsteen did a song a while back with, can't think of the name of the Ghost of Tom Joad. Ghost of Tom Joad was a song about The Grapes of Wrath, the book The Grapes of Wrath.
Oh, okay. Did you like that book?
Yeah, I did. I kind of recommended that people don't read that book again in a Brookings winter, because it's not a very uplifting book, but it's beautifully written.
So, speaking of protests, there was a women's march recently. Do you have any opinions on that?
Yeah, I was right in the middle of it. In fact, I was part of the organizing of it last year when we discussed that we have a progressive breakfast that we go to every second Saturday of every month. And somebody said that we should get involved. There was going to be a national march that we should get involved in something. And then somebody stood up and said, well, let's form a steering committee and a mission statement and all the stuff people want to do when they're organizing things. And somebody else said, oh, no, let's just march. Get the word out and we'll have as many people there as we can. And there was well over 200 last year, a few less this year, but equally enthusiastic. And what I was really happy to see was we had an awful lot of great reception from the people driving by. Lots of people waving and agreeing with us, much, much more than last year.
Yes. I was especially happy with that because people would like honk and give us thumbs up, but
yeah.
There was one guy who like was driving by and he started honking violently and he had like the middle finger up and we were like, okay.
That happens. I've been in lots of marches. I've never been in one that everybody agrees with, so.
Yeah. Every time I saw a protester against it, I would like put up the peace sign because I had a peace sign with me. Yeah. I just thought it was ironically funny.
Yeah, you could see by people who would be against equal rights and things of that nature. Yeah, you couldn't,
yeah.
We can't have any of that now.
Yeah.
Peace on earth. Yeah, really radical signs. Right?
So what is the Progressive Breakfast?
It's a meeting of kind of like-minded people. It's not limited to being a Democrat or Green Party or any particular group. And we meet, well, we have been meeting at Sebastian's the second Saturday of every month. But Sebastian's, I understand, has changed hands. And as far as I know right now, we don't have a new place to meet. But we will have it by the second Saturday of next month.
We read in the pilot that at one point you were planning a documentary show about the Vietnam veterans. Tell us more about that show.
I wanted to do a show talking about the war. I planned on having, well, obviously we would interview veterans, but I would interview people who were involved in any way, something like people who protested against the war, people who were in favor of the war, talk to the families who stayed at home, which is something you don't ever hear about. You know, my mother sat home and my wife at that time sat home for 365 days wondering if somebody's going to knock on the door every day, you know, what that was like. Talk about PTSD and all the other things surrounding the war. But oddly enough, I had a lot of trouble getting participants, people who were interested. We got one family that was interested and we talked to one veteran and then some of the other things just did not materialize. We may try it again someday.
Are you a Vietnam veteran?
Yes, I am. I was a combat medic with the 9th Division in the Delta from in 67 to 68. I left about a month after the Tet Offensive.
What was it like being drafted?
Horrible. I couldn't imagine anything worse. I had a cushy little job where I started work at 10 o'clock in the morning and worked till 6, and then wound up in the Army. I was a provincial New Yorker. It's hard to imagine, but New Yorkers are extremely provincial. They have their own little world, and they can't imagine anything else. And I wound up going to South Carolina, and I met people who actually talk like Gomer Pyle. I don't know if you know who Gomer Pyle was, but he played a kind of a dumb Southerner on television. I met adults that couldn't read or write, and just my whole little world was exploded. And then the whole regimentation thing and everything was really upsetting for me. And then the Army in their classic standard, they're always well known for putting you in something you're exactly not suited for. And they made me a combat medic, and I was somebody who had, if I cut my finger, I had to lay down. I couldn't stand the sight of blood. So when I was going through training and they would show films of treating traumatic wounds, I would pass out and then they'd stop the camera and they would give a class on psychogenic shock with me being the prop. So what they did is they had me kind of watch movies a little bit and then I'd have somebody sit with me and say, okay, you can look now. You can't look now. Look away. And then gradually I get used to watching the movies. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to deal with the sight of blood until I actually had my first casualty. Fortunately, that was at night, so it didn't matter a whole lot. I couldn't see the blood. But anyway, I did get used to it, and it was a fortunate thing because I could not have been a police officer if I couldn't deal with that.
So there's some medical students here who take medical classes and stuff. What advice would you give them?
Well, being a medic isn't really, it's, you don't get a whole lot of medical training. You get training in what now would be about the equivalent of an EMT. I could do some things an EMT can't do, but there was not a lot of medical training involved in it. Bill Cosby used to do a bit. He was a Navy corpsman, and he said the training was really intense. He said the instructor said, "Today we're going to discuss anatomy," and he held up one of those little plastic see-through dolls that you can see all. And the next subject will be, and that was about the way it was. It was my job was to stop bleeding, splint bones, maybe do CPR or something like that, and put somebody on a helicopter, which fortunately were usually pretty close. So I don't really have any real medical experience.
I actually took a EMT class when I was in the 7th grade. It was a lot of fun.
Well, give you an idea of the how well we were trained. It was a 10-week course, and it covered everything from being like a hospital orderly type job to being a field medic. And at the end of the course, they gave you all of the final tests, and one of the final tests was a practical where you went from station to station, and there would be a casualty there of some sort, and the sergeant that was in charge of the practical would say, okay, this person has this symptom and that symptom, and then you can see broken, what would you do? And if you answered the question correctly, you got, say, 10 points. If you said, I don't know, or you tried and you got it wrong, you got 5 points. And if you said, I don't know, you got 3 points, and 3 was the passing score. So they had a policy called no defects and zero defects. So you were not going to flunk out of medical.
They kind of did the same thing with us, where we all got together for our test that we had to do. And everybody was kind of like giving each other answers, sort of, which we're not supposed to do, but it's fine. And then the guy just kind of took our test and gave us all A's.
Yeah.
Because we were working together. And then he also had us do sort of like that exercise where you go around and you help people that were actors and stuff. And we had to get them out of a building that collapsed. And they trashed the place to make that look realistic. Yeah. It was pretty cool. But, yeah.
Yeah, the Army was an interesting experience. Actually, for me, it turned out to be a good experience. It wasn't for everybody, but I got to grow up. I learned there was someplace other than Long Island, and got to travel a little bit and learn some new things, and left with a whole other attitude about life. And I was able to attend college on the GI Bill too. So,
yeah, that's always one of the perks about being in the military. Mm-hmm. You get to go through college scot-free. What degree did you get in college?
I didn't get a degree. I went nights. And I was going full-time nights. I was actually making more money going to school nights than I did as a full-time Army sergeant, because there was no taxes or anything out of it. But I was studying police science.
You're listening to a Bruin Radio interview with Ray Gary. We're broadcasting on KCIW LP out of Brookings, Oregon on 100.7 FM. Now, back to the interview.
I started out to be a physician's assistant, which was a brand new field at that time that was originally designed to convert some of these people that were in medical fields in the Army and the military to use that training. But I switched over to police science because I thought that'd be more interesting.
Yeah.
They call the police science, some places they call it forensic science.
Criminology.
Criminology is a different thing. Criminology is the study of criminals.
Yeah, but they kind of branch together sometimes. Yeah.
Criminology was one of the courses, one of the required courses.
If you take criminology, then you have to take the science, and then if you take that, then you have to take criminology.
Do they have that in high school now?
No. I was looking into it for a while there. Oh, okay. Because I'm getting a psychology, some psychology credits, so I was thinking that criminology would be great to go into.
I would recommend, by the way, anybody who is interested in becoming a police officer to not take a police science, not a pursue a police science degree. I would do something more in psychology or computer sciences and things like that. When you sign on to be a cop, they teach you how to be a cop, and you could take as elective some of the things like procedural law and some of the other things that, where it's not just training, it's education, but understanding people is more important than the things that they're going to teach you in an academy or teach you on the job.
Yeah. So I hear that you're a state trooper. Is there any funny stories you could tell us?
Funny stories? Wow. You put me on the spot there. I can't think of one offhand. Being a state trooper in Alaska, at least when I was doing it, was a very interesting job. I spent a lot of time. I lived in Nome for a while, and my beat, more or less, was the Seward Peninsula. And we would fly out to the different villages. And this was before the villages had television, so there was still a lot of subsistence lifestyle going on. I would imagine by now things have changed a bit, but I really enjoyed my time out there. It was exciting. I was a search and rescue coordinator along with other things, and that was an adventurous job at times. Sometimes I'd be sitting home relaxing, watching television, and the phone would ring, and I would be calling all over the Seward Peninsula to try to find a helicopter to take me out and search for somebody or go recover a body or do something like that. It was a tragic job and a fun job. I used to tell kids at Career Day that there was times I was having so much fun I couldn't believe I was being paid, and at other times I was asked to do something I wouldn't do for all the money in the world. So,
yeah. I bet you got a lot of calls like that, and
yeah.
Must have not been that fun. Did you ever have to, like, pull people over or anything?
Yeah, I worked in the town I spent most of my time in, Healy. I was... Healy's a small town, and there's one trooper, and you basically do everything. If there's a homicide, you do it. If there's an annoying phone call, and in the interim, I would work traffic. Yeah.
So you must have already had a lot of police training going on there. There's quotation marks around that.
Well, we have the Trooper Academy, and then you go through various training officers, and generally they keep you in a city environment or someplace where you have a lot of support until they feel like you can go off and work in a place where you're on your own, or someplace like Nome where you'll go out to a village and you'll be the only one to deal with things. Things were interesting at that time. I would sometimes charter a plane to go to three or four villages in a day, and in the first village I'd do an investigation and find that somebody had committed a crime, and I'd go interview him, and then pretty generally would confess to it, and I'd say, well, okay, I'm going to be coming back this way in about 3 or 4 hours, and when you see the 207 land, come on out and meet me. And they would be under arrest, and they would always come out and meet me. And so it was a different sort of way. I can't imagine a cop here going through Brookings and say, well, when I come back in 2 hours, you're going to come with me. You know?
Yeah, that wouldn't work out so well.
No,
they'd be, like, in Hawaii by then. I heard that you wrote a letter.
Yes, I've examined the evidence, and yes, that was me. I'm guilty.
This letter is to Trump.
Right.
Is it all right?
So out of context, this was written about a year ago, right after he fired the FBI director. By sending him an email or whatever it is that he did. Didn't even do that, I don't think. The FBI director saw it on television. That's how he learned about
it. Yeah, he did it on press conference and kind of just called him out. And okay, is it all right if I read your letter
sure.
to our viewers? All right. Letter to Trump. Dear Mr. Trump, you are now President of the United States of America. You are no longer a reality TV star. Over the last year, you have, on many occasions, demonstrated your lack of knowledge concerning American history and how the government works. However, even you should be aware of all the past presidents have been adults. Criticizing leaders have existed since men were scratching messages on rocks. Both in serious commentary and satire. No other president has responded by calling critics overrated, untalented, not funny, ugly, and fat. There are no mirrors in the White House. Or worse yet, calling them the enemy of the people. Also, was your decision to fire a high-level government employee such an emergency that it could not wait until he got back to D.C.? At least you could have been let go in an appropriate manner. Then maybe you could have relieved the old days by saying, "You're fired," to his face. At least you could have told him before the press release, so he didn't have to learn about his firing from the enemy of the people. Time to put on your big boy pants with your little hands and act like an adult. Ray Gary, Harbor. So, what led to you writing this letter?
Well, just the ridiculous things that are in it. The idea of him firing the head of the FBI without even telling him. He literally had to read. As I understand, he was giving a speech, and there was a monitor in the back of the room, and he saw it on this monitor while he was giving the speech. And he wasn't going to be allowed to take a government aircraft home. Just ridiculous, childish things. And the idea that Trump was responding to all his critics by attacking them as opposed to the ideas they might be putting out.
So if President Trump were to respond to your letter, what do you imagine he might say?
Well, I've put on about 10 pounds, so he'd probably call me fat. I'd certainly be the enemy of the people. And maybe, what's the latest thing they have now?
S-H-I-T hole.
I'm sorry?
S-H-I-T hole country?
No. The something state, the understate or the...
Deep state.
The deep state. I'd be a member of the deep state and part of the secret FBI conspiracy.
Oh.
It's kind of interesting because all the FBI people I worked with were very, very conservative, so I don't know where this FBI conspiracy is coming from.
So you worked with FBI agents, I see.
Well, yeah, as a trooper, you work with all kinds of agents, ATF, FBI, BLM.
Who was the last president you were happy with?
I wasn't unhappy with Obama. I think Obama could have done more than he did. I could not believe that Bush was actually elected a second time after the mess he got us into in Iraq, especially the way he was elected by criticizing his opponent, who in fact volunteered for Vietnam two times or three times, and he also was somebody that had a great deal of political influence. He didn't have to go in the military at all if he didn't want to. He could have copped out like Bush did. And for some reason or other, veterans were backing Bush over Kerry, even though Kerry was, in fact, a war hero. I don't understand that at all. Kerry came back and made speeches in Congress about the Vietnam War. Those were not against the troops. Those were against the Vietnam War policy, not the troops. But somehow or other, it was misinterpreted.
Do you think that Trump will finish his term?
And I'll be able to edit that back.
Okay.
And your answer was... I'm sorry. Did you say yes or no?
Yes, I think he probably will. Mm.
But you don't think he'll be reelected?
Well,
I think if he finishes it, he just might be reelected. He's done enough things that make people happy as far as creating jobs and things like that, even though that's kind of a false flag. It's not really creating the jobs he says he is, but people believe about anything. So.
Who did you vote for if it wasn't Trump?
For Clinton, although she wasn't... My first choice, I would have much preferred to have Bernie Sanders. He makes a lot of common sense. I've been listening to him for years when he's been on talk shows and things like that, and he just does make sense. But some reason or other, people that make sense in the political world seem to get put aside somehow.
Yeah, they're calling Bernie Sanders actually the godfather of America right now.
Godfather of America?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Yeah, he had a very big following, and it's just so hard to be like an outside candidate and fight your way in. And Hillary had so much support from so many people.
Do you think that Hillary should have won with the majority of the people's votes?
Well, yeah, 3 million, that's quite a majority. Yeah, that's not a marginal win by any means.
Yeah. I do remember when Obama was elected.
I was in the Democratic headquarters in Tucson when he was elected, and if you're pretty sure your candidate's going to win, go to the headquarters of that office, and it's really exciting. Unlike here, the Democratic office isn't what it wasn't then what it is now. It's been spiffied up a lot since LaRose took it over. There was about 8 people in there, and my wife and I brought 2 bottles of champagne that we brought home with us, and everybody was just sitting, and we got there late enough to realize that Hillary was losing, and the mood just went down and down and down. Unlike in Tucson, when everybody was cheering, and it was just a great, great time. But
yeah, I remember that night I was watching it on my Twitter feed. Back to the Twitter again.
Yeah.
I was watching it on my Twitter feed that night, and it was really saddening because I was having my hopes up for her because she would have been a whole new revolution going on there, having a woman in office and
We have a whole new revolution, but it's a little different revolution yeah. than it would have been, yeah.
A little bit different than what I was hoping for. But.
Yeah, the whole community, I mean, at least among the Democrats or the liberal end of the community was just, it took me months, literally. I'm still not completely over it every time I see him bringing up stupid policies and doing stupid things. 30% tariff on solar panels and things like
that. I kind of want to write a letter about him kicking out transgender.
And environment is a big deal to me, and every time I see him doing something to destroy it, it's just really bad.
Were you in Alaska when Sarah Palin was the running mate for John McCain?
Yes. Sarah Palin was the governor of Alaska, and she was very popular for a couple of reasons. One, the reasons she was popular here, she was cute and bubbly and gave all these silly speeches and stuff. The Alaska press is not like the press would be in a big city here. They're polite and nice, and an interview with her or any candidate for office would not be very hard-hitting. So she was able to win. She talks about beating the incumbent governor in the primaries. The incumbent governor in the primaries got 19%. He was absolutely awful. He did things that were cruel. One of the things he did was we used to have what they call a longevity bonus that was discontinued. No new people were going to get it. If you'd lived in Alaska for so many years, and it was a long, long time, when you turned 70 or something like that, you got a small amount of money each month, a couple of $100s, maybe it was more than that. It had been discontinued years ago. No new people were getting into it. When this governor took office, he just discontinued it. And for a lot of these people, a few $100s a month was probably a big deal. And he just stopped it. And it cost very, very little money. And obviously each year it was becoming less and less because these older people were dying or leaving the state. But anyway, Sarah Palin won. She was very well liked. She took on the oil companies, as they say. She made sure they paid taxes and didn't give them the tax breaks and things like that that other governors had given her. And she hadn't really been doing a whole lot, but she was extremely popular. She had an approval rating somewhere in the 80s. All my liberal friends loved her. And then she was announced to be the candidate for vice president. And oddly enough, we got phone calls. My wife and I both got phone calls from people living all over the country that we hadn't seen in years that called up just to see how we were doing. You know, and they wanted to find out about her. And within the very first speech that she gave was full of lies. And everybody in Alaska knew they were lies. And we considered it like a bad Disney movie, like when, you know, the Dalmatian gets elected to something or something like that. And it just got worse and worse and worse, and she turned out to be an embarrassment. And then she just quit because she didn't want to do it anymore. And because she could get very, very rich writing books and doing speaking tours and things like that. So.
Ray, what have you been up to lately?
Well, the radio station's been keeping me pretty busy. I foolishly volunteer for almost everything I could volunteer for, including things that I wasn't capable of doing, so I've learned to stop doing that. And between the discussions at Perkins Cafe and my music show, that keeps me busy enough for a retired person. When I put together my show, so far I've just been using my own CDs, so I've been digging through, finding surprise songs here and there that may have been done by somebody that you wouldn't expect, And then in some cases I do research on the song to find out what the history of it and things. So I probably spend 3 or 4 hours preparing for an hour show and then an hour and a half or so recording it, and then I edit it and it goes from there. You know, I grew up in New York, not New York City, but Long Island, and it's still a large population, lots of things, and I was bored to death. So it just seems to me that's part of being a teenager. But there probably is not a lot for teenagers here. They don't have dances or anything like that? Or
We do every once in a while, but they're not really... I'm going to say this, and I'm going to feel really bad for the party committees and stuff, but it's not fun, to be perfectly honest. There's not much to do. There's just a bunch of music blasting and a bunch of really sweaty teenagers wearing dresses and suits.
Are you required to wear dresses to them?
No, you're not required, but everybody just assumes that it's required and goes like that, and it's not fun. I went to the last one with one of my friends, Peter, and... who is a part of the show sometimes when he shows up. But we went together, and it was fun because we were together and we have a lot of fun together because we're both sarcastic and rude people together. So we had fun, and we would judge other people's suits because that's the only thing we could do.
So what would you do to change it? If you were... on the city council here, what would you do to help teenagers?
Personally, I would probably make kind of like a hangout spot, kind of like a coffee shop that's leaning more towards like teenagers or something like that. Because we have coffee shops here, but they're not necessarily leaning towards teenagers.
We probably would rather not have you there, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And or I'll go into coffee shops every once in a while to get a cup of coffee because... caffeine. And I'll get looked at sometimes by like the people who are there, and they'll be like, why is there a teenager here?
Huh.
Or like have an actual Starbucks here. That would be great, not just one in Fred Meyer's, because that's a little bit weird going in Fred Meyer's to get coffee. And the Dutch Bros are only a drive-through.
We used to have school dances. They call them sock hops and things like that. And not being a dancer, I used to go just because everybody was there, you know, and you go and hang out. And then they had a thing called what they called teenage, which was you had to be 13 to go, and they just like one of the multi-purpose rooms in the school. They had a record player in there, and you could dance, and they probably had ping pong and other things. I don't remember,
yeah.
But just a place to kind of go and hang out. I don't know if that would work today or not, or even if it worked then, for that matter.
Yeah, we would have something more like an Xbox in there.
Well, what?
We would probably have something more like an Xbox in there, because there's not going to be...
Oh, yeah, you wouldn't have... I mean, yeah. We had 45s, you know, the turntable, yeah.
If we had, like, a ping pong table, there would be, like, a couple of nerds like me going in there, and that's about it.
Yeah.
I'd probably go in there just to mess around with the ping pong table.
You'd definitely have to modernize that up. Well, we didn't have the internet or anything like that. You know, I had black and white television that big that had, even in New York, we had like 3 stations. And,
yeah.
You know, not much to watch. So I guess that's a big thing. If you're a teenager, you're going to be bored.
Yeah.
And I don't know what I would do here if I was a teenager.
I just went to a sushi place with my friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and then we were bored.
But which?
And then we went to Fred Meyer's to mess with some of their coworkers, but got bored there too.
Another thing that was becoming popular just before I got drafted, a friend of mine opened one. It was like a teenage nightclub with no alcohol, and it would otherwise it was kind of like an adult nightclub or a bar.
Yeah. That would be cool.
And they'd really have live bands and things like that.
Ooh, that would be really cool. We should do that. Let's get this together, Mr. Tittman. First TV, and now we're making nightclubs. This has been Bridget Mitchell with the Bruin News, here with Ray Gary. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you very much for having me. We enjoyed it.
Always welcome here.
You've just listened to an episode of Bruin Radio Interviews, an hour-long interview show brought to you by the students and staff of the Brookings Harbor High School in partnership with Curry Coast Community Radio, KCIW. Content for this program is provided by the Brookings Harbor High School. To view the credits for this episode, visit kciw.org/credits. Here is a quick selection of the highlights from Bruin Radio Episode 52. You can hear the full Episode 52 by tuning in to 100.7 FM throughout the week, or going online to the Brookings Harbor High School radio website or the kciw.org website. Bruin Radio has received a special press release from the Brookings Harbor School District Administration Office. The press release states that the official graduation rate for Brookings Harbor High School Class of 2017 is 76.98%. Compared to the statewide rate of 76.65%, this is good news. The press release notes that this is the first time since the state of Oregon began tracking the graduation rate in its current form in 2008 to 2009 that the Brookings Harbor School District has surpassed the statewide average graduation rate. For more information about this press release, please contact the district office of our school.
Bruin Radio has been making the rounds in the food world at our school district, finding out how foods and agricultural products make their way to our school. We recently connected with Michelle Pruden, who, among many things, heads up our Youth Transition Program, or YTP. Briefly, YTP helps students with disabilities prepare for employment or career-related post-secondary training. The YTP program has many supporters, and one of them is the Rotary Organization. Their efforts to support YTP are headed up by Susan and Kurt Lunsford. The Lunsfords recently donated several crates of fresh apples and bell peppers. Michelle Pruden told our reporters a story that a truck crashed somewhere up near Medford, and the pickles and peppers that the truck carried were acquired by Rotary and provided to our classroom. Naturally, the pickles and peppers were undamaged in the crash. No person was picking pickles and peppers off the street. Bruin Radio reporter Jeremy reached out to Susan Lunsford of Rotary, and we would like to read the email she sent us.
Hi, Jeremy. About 10 years ago, the Medford Rotary Club, with other clubs such as Port Orford, chose one of the Rotary's avenues of service to feed hungry people. It started with 3 truckloads of food a year brought into Curry County. The Port Orford Club has taken the lead for Curry County and developed these resources. As the process has grown, the Rotary Clubs have brought over 100,000 pounds of food items a year, 2016 and 17. Some plant gardens glean commercial gardens and overstocked items from retail stores. When we have a delivery to the Brookings area, many nonprofit groups receive these items. Brookings Food Bank, Soup Kitchens, Outreach, Gospel Mission, School District 17C, Checo Activity Center. I believe Rotary's first donation to Mrs. Pruden's YTP class was vegetable seeds for the Little Bear Garden, the K-School greenhouse, and now the YTP garden. The Coos Bay Rotary Club seeds dozens of gardens in Southern Oregon and Northern California. Rotary networks through our communities, states, and nations around the world. We could not do this work without volunteers that want to better Brookings and Curry County. The Brookings Rotary Club has one major fundraiser a year, the Raining Cats and Dogs event, and will do that again in 2018. But in Rotary Service, Susan Lunsford. Susan, this is Jeremy. Thank you so much for replying to me. And this is a great letter, and I appreciate it so much.
Susan Lunsford is also on the board of directors for the Brookings Harbor Scholarship Foundation, which offers scholarships to graduates of the Brookings Harbor High School. We plan to explore inviting Susan Lunsford to be interviewed by our student journalists on our show. So if you're listening, Susan, please expect an email from one of our students sometime soon. That's not all of the news from Michelle Pruden. She and her students are also involved in the upcoming Empty Bowls fundraiser. This fundraiser, hosted by the BHHS National Honor Society, is coming up on the 30th of January. Stop by the high school cafeteria on the 30th, that's Tuesday of this very week, starting at 6:30 for a delicious meal. Entry tickets, which include the meal, are $15, and you can buy a handcrafted bowl made by our local volunteers for $5. Proceeds go directly to the Empty Bowls Project, an effort to fight hunger, organized by the 501c3 nonprofit organization, the Imagine Render Group.
Now you may ask, how is Michelle Pruden involved? She and her trained student kitchen workers are catering three soups to be served that night. They are making a root vegetable soup, a broccoli cheese soup, and a special chicken and rice soup. How is it special? Apparently, the chicken is actually Cornish game hen. So if you catch this report on Monday or Tuesday early enough, NHS and Michelle Pruden want you to stop by and support Empty Bowls with your purchase of a ticket and, before they run out, a custom-made empty bowl.
There's even more for listeners to know about what Michelle Pruden is up to. At this time, there are 22 students enrolled in work experience who will meet weekly with Mrs. Pruden. Some of the jobs held by these Bruins are in the fields of healthcare, hospitality, and food services.
Students who are enrolled in this class will work or intern in community-based employment following all BOLI laws, those are labor laws, gain first-hand career experience in their preferred career area, build employment foundation skills, build career-specific skills and gain training, increase and continue to foster students' employability skills, and provide students with the opportunity to earn elective credit needed for graduation. This class is a pass-or-fail class. That means it's not going to use a traditional grade. Students will either pass or fail. This pass-or-fail is based on their completion of several assignments that are given in each of the quarters of a semester. Congratulations once again to the January Bruins Students of the Month. They are Robert Green, Kelby Colvin, Dominic Blank, and Jewel Kachadorian. Students of the Month receive special t-shirts and a free pizza lunch from Zola's Pizzeria. Congratulations.
Two Brookings Harbor High School students are working diligently on a project to support the Oasis Shelter Home in Gold Beach, as well as the Oregon Department of Human Services and Oregon Coast Community Action. The students are Jed Doan and Shannon Cowan. They're organizing and bagging several dozen boxes worth of toiletries and hygiene items. These items include soaps, shampoos, body lotion, diapers, and deodorant. The Oasis Shelter Home is an organization based in Gold Beach. Bruin radio reporter Jeremy Pettinger called the Oasis Shelter Home and spoke with Melanie Caldera, a healthcare advocate working with their organization. Melanie explained that the Oasis Shelter Home's relationship with Curry Community Health involves medical screenings, mental health services, counseling, and of course, shelter. She also connected us with a manager of the Oasis Shelter from whom we can learn more, and we'll report further on this organization in future episodes. Oregon Coast Community Action, or OR-CCA, is a private nonprofit organization. ORCA manages a variety of programs you may recognize, such as CASA, which is Court-Appointed Special Advocates for Children, and the South Coast Head Start Program. Among the board members of this organization is the Gold Beach City Representative position held by Carl Popoff, the mayor of Gold Beach.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.
You've tuned in to KCIW-LP out of Brookings, Oregon on 100.7 FM. We're Curry Coast Community Radio, a nonprofit corporation providing a free and open medium for the sharing of creative content, thoughts, and opinions on the air. Our organization is entirely volunteer-powered, and all generously donated funds go towards the maintenance of the station, its equipment, and its programming. If you would like to become one of our fantastic donors, visit us on our website, kciw.org. Check on the tab that says Donate.